Thank you very much for this invitation, and it's a pleasure to be at this important celebration of the anniversary of InterEconomics and the sister journal. My discussion will fit, I hope, very nicely with the two previous ones, focusing on, in particular, the demand side. The previous speakers has shown that there are strong limitations to what action on the supply side, the stock of capital, the quantity of labor, the importance of structural reform can achieve in improving Europe's situation. And my argument is that Europe's crisis today is basically a question of lack of demand. Let's say, we know that since the crisis, private investment has failed to recover significantly everywhere. There is a long-term fall, and private investment, of course, is pro-cyclical, and there is no the direction for this. Public expenditure have been heavily constrained by fiscal rules with the aim of bringing deficit down to zero. Exports, which have been for decades the golden egg of the golden recipe for Europe's growth, now are falling at the global level. At the global level, exports are growing less than GDP. We have BRICS country, emerging countries in a recession, China reorienting its economy. And of course, in the context of higher inequality, as Laszlo described before, we are in a situation where even if households have greater incomes for consumption, and if there is a high inequality, the dynamism brought about by consumption flows is much smaller. So without demand growth, there is no hope for GDP growth. And of course, we have to decide where do we start. The obvious place to start is investment, because investment has a short-term effect as a boost to demand, but at the same time improves the structure of economic activities, makes possible expanded production, more efficiency, more productivity, more technological change, more innovation. However, the nature of private investment is such that even with extremely favorable conditions, such as quantitative easing, monetary policy, and high liquidity in the financial systems, private firms do not pick up the opportunity to make investment. Why? Because the demand is not there. And therefore, we have public investment which can fill this gap, especially in the short term. It is a well-tested policy tool, and there is a very large consensus on a return of investment plans driven by public decisions, which at the same time improve demand, improve supply structures, improve infrastructure, creating externalities for private action. And of course, within the public investment strategy, a focus on social investment, on activities that can improve income equality, social cohesion, regional and territorial cohesion, can play a very important role. So, just a brief look at how bad is the fall of total investment as a share of GDP in Europe. This is the IMF 2014 report showing the long-term fall of real public investment in advanced economies. This includes Japan and the US as well as Europe. We see that real public investment is just 3% of GDP, 150% lower than a few decades earlier. And if we look at major EU countries, we see that after the crisis, the fall in public investment, which is mainly constrained by austerity policies at the fiscal level, have been 11% fall in the euro area as a whole, and a dramatic fall of 23% in Italy and 48% in Spain, underlining the dramatic restructuring and contributing to the divergence in performance that Laszlo Andor has shown before. Interestingly enough, we are in the midst of a transition towards, hopefully, a more sustainable economy. And what is happening to green private and public investment? This is taken from Mariana Mazzucato's work on the green entrepreneurial state. And Europe is now, which is the top line, after, as a result of the crisis, has had a collapse of its environmentally sustainable investment, and China is now doing more than Europe does in this regard. Is this what we want for Europe? Is this the quality of investment and growth that we want for Europe? We probably need to reverse this fall, this collapse of public investment, and there are four main reasons. The first one is, of course, the macroeconomic reason. The demand side story, a massive boost to public investment would allow a major improvement of demand and bring us out of the stagnation, and our output would eventually move up in the at European level as a whole. The second dimension is the structural one, because investment shape what we produce, what we can produce, our technology, our innovation. And in this context, the divergence is much within European countries, is much more dangerous, because we are constructing an economic machine which goes in different direction at different speeds. And this is seriously dangerous. And clearly, in this context, we have to look at the structural change that we are facing and the need to reorganize our production towards more environmentally sustainable activities, to make full use of ICTs, and to come to terms to the aging of our population and to the strengths of Europe in health and welfare systems. Europe has a very has the best world systems for addressing health problems and managing an aging society, but we don't understand, we don't think of this as a major strength of our economies. A third reason is the one that was already discussed by Laszlo Andor very well, the cohesion both within countries, reducing inequality, and within the European Union as a whole, across countries and across regions. And the fourth reason is of course, the longer-term ecological sustainability, which I will not address in this talk. For all these reasons, we need a new policy and the governance arrangements in the Europe which allow us to do these things. Let's go into each of these aspects. The macroeconomic argument. Everybody is saying that we need investment. The OECD and the G7 have been saying in the last few years that the world needs a massive public investment, public infrastructure boom. The IMF is saying the same thing. We have additional studies for different countries. That's the IMF World Economic Outlook of 2014, and basically there is a whole chapter devoted to the need for infrastructure push, arguing that an infrastructure push driven by public investment would increase demand and increase growth and improve the supply structures, and that these can be efficiently financed by increased public debt. Public debt is not a problem. In this case, is a solution, because in the simulation of the IMF, of course, we can exclude some countries with extremely high debt, but for the majority of countries, the simulation by the IMF study showed that a massive debt-financed program of public investment increases GDP and lowers the debt-to-GDP ratio. The IMF also emphasized the importance of the Golden Rule. You know that the Golden Rule has been long debated in Europe. The idea is that we introduce the rule that excludes investment expenditure from the limitation of fiscal consolidation within the European, within the euro area rules. Okay? So we take out public investment from the limitation of the fiscal compact, the growth and stability pact, and so on. This is what the IMF asks, okay, very clearly. This is what the IMF argues, that improved the countries, the simulation they do is that the countries which were able to have a sort of golden rules, basically the countries where fiscal consolidation did not hit investment spending in government budgets had a much better performance after the crisis than countries that which had to reduce to shelve public investment, as we have seen in the previous graphs. Very recently, Lawrence Summers again argues in his website not only that there is a consensus that the U.S. should substantially increase its level of infrastructure, but it gives a figure, 1% of GDP over a decade, $2,200 billion of dollars. This should be debt-financed, on the obvious argument that with the interest rates that are so low now, it's much cheaper to finance infrastructure through public debt than going to financial markets which demand private returns, which are much higher. And this, of course, would crowd in also private investment with an important aspect. What has Europe done in this context? Europe has prevented countries to do public investment on their own, as Europe had not introduced a golden rule, and has done a little bit with the Juncker plan. We have two studies assessing 1 year later the impact of the Juncker plan of investment. This study by Bruegel, this Brussels think tank, basically argues that there is little additionality, little novelty in the projects that are funded, so is more or less more of the same. The Juncker plan is not really funding new high-risk projects which could have greater productivity and greater innovative effects on European economies. A French study by the OFSE, the title is probably too little, certainly too late, argues that as it is, the Juncker plan is likely not going to be effective at all in terms of macroeconomic performances, in terms of improving the pace of European GDP growth. Why? Because the anti-cyclical effect could have been significant had the plan been introduced at the same time as the American anti-crisis plan just after the crisis. So this plan has arrived too late, and now the amount of resources that are needed to turn European economies around is much higher. So this was the macroeconomic demand side argument. What about the structural argument? Well, here we have a special issue of intereconomics with a set of interesting contributions which focus exactly on this issue. Which industrial policy does Europe need? We are facing divergence in economic activities, greater imbalances across countries. By the way, these greater imbalances are producing the seeds for balance of payments imbalances if the growth comes back, increasing risk of instability and disintegration. So a European investment plan could really be a silver bullet to address all these challenges. Just to take a look at what has been happening as a result of the crisis in industrial output, okay? Not really much less than we expected. The most important change has been this increase of China in terms of shares of manufacturing value added at a global level. And this has been basically compensated by a fall of non-German European manufacturing production. Okay? Japan and the US had very minor changes in their shares of global production in manufacturing. In terms of employment, it's Europe South which has paid the largest price after 2008 in terms of losses in jobs. Europe's North, including Germany, of course, has maintained a stable employment. This is a complement to the graph that Laszlo Andor has already shown. This is just manufacturing production, okay, not GDP. And we see again the top line, which is Poland, the Eastern European dynamism and the convergence, which is a good news, of course. But of course, a lot of this is subcontracting and offshoring out of the German production system. Germany is the green line, stable, has reached back the level of pre-crisis industrial production. Spain and Italy are the two bottom lines with 25% of fall of industrial production. this is not a short-term fall, this is not a cyclical downturn, it's a structural break, introducing a structural divergence between the production ability of core, German-centered countries of the core, and the southern European periphery. Interestingly enough, why the southern countries have this fall? Not because they are less competitive. Look at the non-domestic market sales of these countries. Italy and Germany are exactly on the same level. They overlap just under the Polish line. Okay, so Italian firms have been able to export, to recover their export activities at the same level as German firms. What has been collapsing is domestic demand. If you do austerity policy and you have a collapse of domestic GDP and domestic demand, the bottom two countries, again, Spain and Italy, are unable to recover. So we are in a situation whereby the double deep recession in Europe is something which is of our own making, and we are introducing a structural imbalance in our system, which is going to have long-term consequences. Fine. The third issue, the cohesion argument, has been already pointed out by Laszlo in detail, so I can skip. I did some little advertising for my book on inequality, where we show that the crisis has had a polarizing effect in employment and wages within Europe. You see that with the crisis, the job losses and the income losses, okay, have gone to the blue collar workers in particular, okay. This means that there is this wage impoverishment which drives most countries to greater inequality. This is the Gini index of inequality in household income before taxes, which has been increasing rapidly all over Europe. And in this context, what is Europe doing? It's doing something. Europe 2020 goals, where, by the way, there is the notion of poverty, but not the goal on inequality as a whole, and a lot of these activities. We can look at the Juncker plan as a part of, not as in its macroeconomic effect, but on its structural effect, as a term which, if we look at the evolution of European policy, including the industrial compact, the renewed talk about the need for an industrial policy in Europe, we can see that the Juncker plan can be understood as an investment plan reshaping, which aims at reshaping some European capabilities. We have done quite a lot of work on industrial policy in Europe. Interestingly enough, if we look at the amount of European resources, this is the current European budget, there is quite a substantial amount, which is the bottom part, of resources which are we can really interpret as funding industrial policy, funding investment and aimed at reshaping industrial capabilities. Okay, clearly, the red one is the Juncker plan and the role of the European Investment Bank, but within the cohesion fund, the economic and social strategies, we have significant resources that go already in this direction. But of course, we shy away from calling this explicitly a European investment plan or a European industrial policy. This is the complex arrangement of how Europe works, but we can really think that building on this analysis, the need for demand, the need for demand which is able to improve the economic structure, the economic competences, and the need to create a greater structural convergence in economic competences within Europe to prevent further imbalances. What Europe can discuss now is really the potential of a public investment plan. By the way, there has been a very large number of proposals in the last 4 or 5 years, starting from the German trade union Dagebe proposing a Marshall Plan for Europe. Then there was the Green proposing the Green investment plan. There were a number of proposals, including some that we have produced. Basically, if we think of a 10-year plan for investing 2% of Europe's GDP, this means 260 billion for 10 years, we have an immediate effect, bringing us out of the stagnation, and we are in the condition for improving and reshaping the capabilities of European economies in the, reducing the convergence if we make an explicit policy decision that these resources should be devoted to recreate a greater convergence. So supporting the convergence of newly accessed European countries in the East and avoiding the north-south divergence that we have been monitoring. Where the money can come from? This is an interesting question, and in the afternoon there will be additional session on this. Obviously, this cannot be money coming from national resources with the fiscal constraints. But of course, the golden rule can really help allowing countries to devote resources to public investment. We have introduced a mechanism whereby with EFSI, the European Investment Bank mobilizes a broad range of funds. Why don't we allow the European Investment Bank or some other investment banks to borrow money at zero interest rates from the European Central Bank, and with the specific goal of investing directly this money into the domestic, into the national investment strategies that can be introduced. In this way, we are sure that this money is not into a liquidity trap, but goes straight into real investment, straight into demand, and this allows that there can be lots of different institutional arrangements. And of course, the priorities should be even stricter than within the Juncker plan to avoid the additionality, the lack of additionality and the lack of novelty that have been pointed out. But clearly, in these environmental ICT and public services activities, this could be very interesting. This would be interesting the direction for work. The tools, the specific tools of the investment could be very different, moving from public research and public procurement program. Mariana Mazzucato's emphasized the American import, the American lessons of this public procurement program with mission-oriented innovation and R&D content, but we can emphasize broader support to R&D and also a clear role for public investment in generating new innovative activities which are not really supported. So there is a huge room for debate for turning this direction into a more concrete and viable policy agenda, but I think this is an important direction for our discussion. Thank you.